Geico makes it easy to get affordable renter's insurance in as little as 90 seconds. And then you'll start to wonder why everything else isn't so fast. Like, why does it take so long to do the dishes? A meal that's gone in three requires 45 minutes worth of dishes. Doesn't make sense. But it does make sense to get renter's insurance through Geico. That way, that pile of dirty dishes and the other things you love are covered. Get more with Geico.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Gray Malkin Lane podcast Patreon channel. I am so honored to be joined by my friends Kevin and Jeff. Kevin Canary is a delightful human who I've had on the show a few times after meeting at a con last year, and the incredible writer Jeff Jensen, who I've followed for years and who I had on the main show quite recently. I'd love for you to both introduce yourselves. Just tell everybody a little about yourself. Let us know your pronouns. And we're going to jump into a series that Jeff wrote in the early 2000s that is very often overlooked and kind of connected to the X-Men without being directly connected in some ways. It's X-Factor Volume 2. It has that title. And it's a four-issue limited series that is surprisingly great. I mean, not surprisingly, given that Jeff wrote it, but it's really good. So let me have you both introduce yourselves. Let's start with Jeff.
My name's Jeff Jensen. He, him. I'm calling myself a writer these days. Generically speaking, I write in various mediums, whether it's comics or in television or movies or freelance writing for studio projects. I do a little bit of everything. I wrote a graphic novel about my father called Green River Killer, a true detective story. And as I like to joke, he's not the killer, he's the detective. And it's a story about his 20 years investigating the Green River Killer and what happened when he finally caught him. I worked on the HBO show Watchmen with Damon Lindelof and wrote a movie with him, Tomorrowland, starring George Clooney. And those are kind of my credits.
Kevin?
Hi, I'm Kevin Canary. My pronouns are he, him. And I am mostly associated with merchandise product in the pop culture world. For many, many years, I worked with DC Comics, so I've been involved in the comic industry for quite some time. But always, Marvel has had my heart, and specifically the X characters. So I'm very excited to be here.
Have you read X-Factor Volume 2 before preparing for this episode?
No, and I am so delighted that this was the topic, because during that period of the early 2000s, I was over at DC Comics, so I was reading all of those comics. It was very much job-related, so I'd kind of gone a little cold on some of the Marvel stuff for a while. But always being a big fan of the mutants and any of the X-Factor particularly. So I would have picked it up normally, somehow missed this. Delighted to find this. I think it's a gem. So excited to talk about it.
It's well written and tightly packed and really fun. As I produce more and more content and get to know more and more people, there's just this way of kind of transporting yourself to Marvel at different times. This is the Bill James era. This is the Chuck Austin and Grant Morrison era. I've interviewed Carl Ballers about his series Muties, which came out here, which is another like major overlooked limited series from this kind of era of content. When Jeff came on the show the first time, we talked a lot about social media and like violent comics and the way that those were showing up. I've interviewed Molly Laser and Mike Martz both recently, which takes me back there again. It was a delight to reread this for this particular show. Now, Jeff, beginning going to 2024 and looking back on this book that you wrote back in 2002, we have kind of a harsh lens of political correctness a lot of times in today's day and age. How do you feel X-Factor Volume 2 holds up 22 years later?
Wow. Very mixed feelings when I reread this work of mine. You know, I had worked in comics before this. I worked in comics in the early 90s or mid 90s with a good friend, Phil Jimenez, and we wrote Team Titans for DC Comics. And that was a real like learning experience in writing comics and learning what I thought I could do well and what I didn't do well. And writing Team Titans was definitely like interesting and frustrating in that just trying to learn how to write like just a good, solid superhero comic. And realizing that I'm not good at that and not terribly interested in that. I was really kind of more interested in, well, I didn't know what I was interested in until we get into early 2000s and Grant Morrison takes over X-Men. And I was just so captivated. So this is an indirect way of answering your question. I'm now kind of cutting to the origins of the project, but as a way of sort of answering directly your question, which is I was just really captivated by like one of the high concept premises of Grant's comic, which is that bringing to the foreground something that was always always implied within sort of the evolutionary explanation of mutants. This idea that mutants represented the next step in human evolution, and that if the world was making this sort of like transition between the current form of humanity, Homo sapiens, toward this next form of humanity, which at least Magneto would like to call Homo superior, like eventually Homo sapiens would become extinct and we would be in this protracted period of great social upheaval as one kind of human person gives way to another kind of human person. Just the way articulated that idea, which again, always part of the X-Men thing, kind of really brought that Grant brought to the surface, just kind of captured my imagination for all sorts of ways in which that might play out in society. In particular, I kind of found myself wondering like what the government response would have been to this. And this kind of brings me to the other big formative influence, I think, on me in terms of creating X-Factor, or my take on X-Factor, which was the work of James Ellroy at the time, the great kind of like pulp fiction writer, contemporary pulp fiction writer, and his Underworld USA trilogy, which depicts with great cynicism, but not like completely inaccurate, the role that the FBI played under J. Edgar Hoover, trying to keep a stable, democratic, non-communist society during a period of great social upheaval that he was philosophically and spiritually greatly opposed to, yes. Specifically the civil rights movement and communism. So J. Edgar Hoover using in corrupt fashion the auspices of the powers of the FBI to maintain his version of social order amid all of these other social upheavals that he didn't politically and philosophically agree with.
Yes, breaking the law, using anti-Black and anti-queer, you know, policies, and hurting a lot of people along the way. Absolutely.
Bingo. So I kind of thought that what if our government, in the world of the X-Men, our government was essentially up to that same kind of like subversion and evil, but under the auspices of an agency that was allegedly trying to protect and look out for mutants and specifically hate crimes against them. So I was kind of like, you know, inspired by Grant's work, wondering how the government and our society would manage this period of transition, and imagining this agency under the auspices of the FBI that allegedly was looking out for the civil rights of all people, but especially people who were threatened mutants at this time in this world would still be a minority. Even though they had great power, but would be subject to a lot of civil rights abuses and crime. So ostensibly looking out for them, but as we find out in the series, this agency has been taken over by some virulent anti-mutant sensibilities that is sort of using their privileged position in law enforcement to look out more for Homo sapiens than mutants.
Well, not even just look out for, but to commit crimes, harm people, murder people, infiltrate and expose and arrest people in order to keep a particular privilege in place for a certain group of people.
Exactly.
And it's interesting.
I like how you articulate the meanings of this series so much. You could tell I'm so distant from it these days. But yes, what you said is exactly what I was trying to
I mean, no, it is what you said. It's interesting. You go back to like X-Men number 2 is when we first see Professor X working with Fred Duncan at the FBI, like mutant division. And then later we get that flashback where Xavier, you know, sneaks into the FBI and uses his powers to, you know, Fred Duncan, I am your ally. You even have a guy named Duncan in your series, which is interesting. That's always a piece of it. But we go back, like if we take television history in the 50s and 60s, it was, you know, the FBI agents are absolutely the hero all the time. We're in the 70s, not so much. And under Reagan, we weren't really allowed to question them as much. But in your series, which is the, you know, reality TV, social media, post 9/11, post-Iraq war era, definitely questioning authority again. And we're like openly calling for change. The mutant metaphor is really interesting. And I'm going to get super social worky for a minute. I'm a clinical social worker in my day-to-day life. Oversimplifying this, but we're addressing things like straight privilege and male privilege and white privilege in a different way in modern vernacular. And the flip side of any time we're experiencing privilege is the word fragility on the other side. So if we have white privilege, we have white fragility on the other side. Like, why should I have to give up my rights, my comfort? They're already being oppressed. Let's keep it that way. And when we kind of look at the actions of the corrupt agents in your book and their fragility in the way of, you know, my Christianity is more important than their life or livelihood. You pick some really interesting topics to explore through that lens from different characters. We'll talk about this issue by issue and how that kind of plays out, but I'm really impressed with the work. And to answer the question I asked you at the beginning, I think this work stands up really well in a 2024 lens. Kevin, what was it like for you to jump into this series?
I got to tell you, I can't help but, you know, echo that. It's for something that's 22 years ago, how current and important it feels now. And the very human grounded story was really refreshing, especially, you know, knowing that we're in a very superhero fantastical world. To kind of see that lens of it was really nice kind of break while also going with all these heavy storylines. And also, I got to say, it was masterful. How many different heavy topics were weaved into these four simple issues that felt related, but also, you know, just something that was people are dealing with in many different ways. There was something about it that didn't feel messy or just there for some kind of other story point. They felt like they were fully fleshed out characters that had full lives and their lives were being represented through these stories. I really relate to those kinds of storylines the best. I think there's a lot of levels and deepness to it all. And it just means that I care so much quicker about these characters than something that feels like cardboard cutouts.
Every one of the characters in this book, with the exception of the brief appearances by the X-Men, although never mind, that still applies. But every one of these characters is flawed, sometimes to the point of corruption. And every one of them pushes your issues. The one you want to like most still has like some things you're like, oh, what are your thinking patterns here? With these histories of trauma kind of woven in. It's a really interesting ride. Jeff, comments on kind of just the initial feedback on this before we take it issue by issue.
It really means a lot that you guys feel it stands up and it says something to me today. Like being a writer, like it's hard for me to get that kind of big picture view of this. I see its flaws. I see its messy kind of origins. Just a fun fact here, and we probably might get into it more, that we not so fun fact for me. I had pitched this comic as a 9-issue series. Marvel liked it enough to say we want to do it, but what about 4 issues? Okay, like better 4 than none. But I made an interesting choice that I regret, which was I thought, well, I really liked the greater arc of my 9 issues. And if I had done this in 9 issues, it would have ended in roughly the same space, but it would have had a protracted middle act with a lot of standalone issues and stories, much like issue 2 in this series, and a lot more character development and building between the two main agents. I decided, well, I'll just kind of like take the beginning of my story and I'll take the end of my story and I'll do my one favorite story that I had, standalone story that I brainstormed for it, make that issue 2. And then I'll squish all of the plots that the 9 issues would have told all into 1 issue, issue 3, before telling the final story. I just see a lot of kind of like seams and warts and things that suffered as a result of that compression. So this is all I think about when I read these 4 issues again. This is just a very writerly thing.
I think every writer that I've ever interviewed is like, you know, I had to draft it, I had to change it, I had to alter the ending, or the editors altered it on me and no one else knows what the original intent was. There's these kind of obscure corners I mentioned, like Muties. Some of these obscure series are very well remembered by fans. Like modern fans really are affectionate about the Fallen Angels series from the 80s, for example. But there's a bunch of these from the early 2000s that kind of fill in weird gaps. Another one besides Muties and this X-Factor volume, District X, or like the title Brotherhood, which was like a 10-issue series. There's a bunch of these kind of odd corners of the X-Men universe that just people don't really remember very well.
Was this pitched as an X-Factor story, Jeff, or were you just doing a general like somewhere in this universe?
I pitched it as X-Files meets Mississippi Burning, and very focused on the human characters. I did not have a title for it. The comic X-Factor had recently been canceled or had gone dormant. That title was available, and someone at Marvel thought it would be a good title for this. But I think it ended up really misleading and confusing the readership that really thought that they were getting a reboot X-Factor and instead got this politically charged, deeply influenced by God loves, man and Kills graphic novel thing that had nothing to do with X-Men proper, certainly the core original X-Men. And we're kind of going like, what the hell is this?
So we're going to take this issue by issue and just kind of explore some of the themes and the main characters. This came out in 2002. Your artist on this book is Arthur Ranson. I don't think Arthur is a well-known name at Marvel, but for long-term X-Men readers, he also worked on two more obscure X-Men titles, one of them Soldier X and one of them Extreme X-Men Exposé, which is one of those branch-off titles. What was it like working with Arthur on this book, Jeff?
Well, a legend in his native England and English comics. I absolutely loved his style. I wasn't familiar with his work until I was told to check him out. And I'm like, oh man, I love this guy. I wish I can tell you what it was like to work with Arthur Ranson, because I never had any direct communication with him. I worked through an editor, and I believe that the editor worked with Arthur through fax. So no one had any sort of direct relationship with Arthur Ranson. I admire him greatly. I think that his work on this series is beautiful. I think he did a great job with what he was given. I have since read interviews with Arthur, which I got the sense that he didn't think highly of me per se. And I totally get why. My script writing at the time was very beholden to kind of like almost screenwriting, thinking of writing comics is writing a movie, and that kind of like really kind of like didn't explore more fully what interested him, which was kind of really like pushing the boundaries of just like visual storytelling that is unique to comics and sort of more beholden to kind of like very a lot of exposition, a lot of movie effects and scene and jargon. And I think he was disappointed that like we couldn't push more in a pure comics direction. And I feel for him. I wish we could have done that too.
I've had a number of experiences on this show where I'll form an ensemble for an issue review episode, and there'll be like a writer and an artist from a particular book they did together, and it's their first time meeting on the show. It's always a wild experience. Really fun. I have to draw my own parallel. Not many people have followed any of my personal work, but my first graphic novel that I published back in 2011 was called The Mushroom Murders, which is a white male cop and a black female detective investigating series of supernatural deaths. And it's one of I'm still proud of it. I still have it on my shelf over here. When I read this, I automatically go there a little bit because there's a similar vibe, although they're very different books, of course. You draw on civil rights parodies really widely in your work, to the point that issue one is called The Mountaintop. And there is a lot of reference to Martin Luther King, to Muhammad Ali, to different people. And sometimes the people using those references, you're like, oh no. When the white mutant who is killing people calls himself the new Malcolm X, you're like, like that's the part that doesn't stand up so well, except that it's in the mouth of a bigoted person. So you can see that that is happening. Although I don't know if it would pass the editors in today's comics, those particular things. The book opens, the cover of the first issue is a dead mutant who's had the word muty carved into his corpse. In our conversation on the main show, we drew the parallel to Matthew Shepard, which was 5 years before this was published. I also mentioned to you, I made a documentary about a gay hate crime that took place in 1988. So those types of like overt violence are tricky to portray on the page. It's a jarring opening. There's a body hanging on the Hollywood sign, a kid named Aaron Sumner. You initially believe he is a mutant, but you later learn he is one of the U-Men, or third species from Grant Morrison's books, where they have had a mutant liver put into their body. And they also are working for a corrupt FBI group, which is one of the reveals at the end, is this group is orchestrating things from the beginning. We learn at the beginning there is a group called the Mutant Civil Rights Task Force, which was, quote, organized in response to data showing increases in the number of mutants in the country, as well as the FBI reports of marked increases in hate-driven crimes against other mutants. And the two main characters explored in this book, one of them is Catherine Gray. Jeff, do you want to tell us about the creation of Catherine?
Catherine Gray is the daughter of a very committed and noted civil rights activist from the 60s.
Named Moira Gray.
She politically and ideologically, like, she's African-American, and she agrees a lot with her mother's worldview in politics, but they have a very fraught and frayed relationship because mom was never really around for her daughter during her activist peak. And mom has since gone on to become a major voice and form in the mutant civil rights movement too. So Catherine was influenced by her mom in a positive sense in terms of inspiring her to work for the government and become an agent and look out for protecting the civil rights rights of oppressed minorities and mutants, but she has a lot of deep-seated resentments toward her mom for not really ever being there. And so kind of makes her like a perceived commitment to causes of very complicated. Catherine has another interesting feature is that she's happy she had a child with her husband.
And her husband is Latino. His name is Ramon.
Yes. They had a child that manifested their power, mutant powers early and died. And so they are very haunted by that loss. The character of Catherine Gray was kind of created in part to sort of like, yeah, just really kind of bring into the story in a very on the nose and blunt way, you know, the mutant civil rights metaphor and the legacy of the civil rights movement at that time.
It made me laugh that her mother's name is Moira and Moira's friends with Jean Gray, but her last name's also Gray.
There we go. I'm very bad at names. I don't know exactly like character names. I just stumble into either these mistakes or coincidences, I guess, with my, you know, like very sloppy approach to character names.
Yeah. So Catherine's trying her best to be an FBI agent throughout the series. She is pregnant and considering having an abortion because she's so traumatized by the death of her first child. Her husband doesn't agree with her and kind of her character journey as she's handling the world that is violent against mutants, but also reckoning with a world in which mutants are a danger to themselves. It's interesting to watch where she ends up. We'll get there at the end. Kevin, did you like the character of Catherine Gray?
Immediately. I mean, it is one of those things. I mean, we start with her kind of trauma being placed in front of her. We don't maybe know the whole story right away, but there's something about her that seems like somebody who's dealing with some real life problems, but is pulling it together, kind of working for what we, you know, perceive as the side of good. There's something about her that's just immediately likable or you're rooting for.
And then the other main character is a guy named Aaron Curse. And Aaron's a little harder to like. I feel like Aaron in 2024 would have a MAGA hat on and maybe some anti-certain things propaganda hung around his house in some ways. But you also see that this is a character that's wrestling with things. Aaron is a very Christian character who is kind of on the fence about where things are at. Now in Utah, and again, this is something I researched in my documentary, when they were first talking about anti-trans legislation, there was this conservative politician who got up and was like, if we start letting gay people get married, what's next? My kid can marry his toaster. If we start letting trans people use the bathrooms, what next? My daughter's male coach can shower with her at school. And you're like, where are these parallels coming from? And these are things I feel like Aaron Curse might be hearing at church every week. But he's got a kid and he has a little bit of a tragic background himself. He's a good, wholesome family man who kind of feels like Christians are being persecuted against a little bit. Tell us about the creation of Aaron Curse. Curse, by the way, everybody, is K-E-A-R-S-E.
So it's funny. I was definitely going for the curse metaphor. I think I always pronounced it as like Cursey, Aaron Cursey. Yeah, Aaron was sort of my way of working out, I think, in part, my own Christian upbringing. He's a very earnest Christian who I think in some ways his compass is pointing in the right direction. He's deeply interested in justice. He's deeply interested in fairness. And I think he is deeply interested in a society where everyone that cares about everyone, even people that he doesn't agree with or doesn't understand. But he's also deeply shaped, warped, and owned by a subculture that sees itself in a culture war with, like, you know, the left and other sort of like, you know, like more, he's definitely very conservative ultimately in his politics, but he's definitely owned and identifies with, but maybe not necessarily agree with every part of a more conservative subculture. And like, for example, a defining issue that gives him that troubles his conscience is that his church has just gone through a moment where they were considering becoming what we call the sanctuary church that offered safe harbor to homeless mutants or runaway mutants or kind of looking after them. And his church was very politically polarized along conservative and liberal elements. And the congregation had to vote whether or not they would become a sanctuary church to mutants. They ultimately voted not, I believe. I forget now, but you guys correct me if I'm wrong.
No, you're correct. And Curse is he's interesting because he's conflicted by that, but he's also conflicted by should mutants even exist? He's on a task force that's meant to protect mutants, but he's disgusted by them. Like, I'll help you, but don't touch me or look at me. There's an interesting amount of kind of oppression. Now, I'll be clear, I don't like this character, but I like a conflicted character. Like, William Stryker is clearly much more evil than Aaron Kearse.
He's very conflicted, and he's owned enough by his political, his Christian subculture to lean into his particular Christian subculture's explanation for mutants, which is that they are evil, that they are deeply flawed, that they aren't like human beings. He's that guy, but he's also raising a son who idolizes certainly idolizes a baseball player that he comes to find out is mutant. He has a son who ends up becoming like a way that gets him to inspire him to reevaluate how he relates to his own Christianity or what kind of Christianity he wants to be in the world, but we can get to that later. But yeah, very conflicted character. He's damaged too. Like you find out that one of his core origin stories is that he ran afoul with a mutant arms dealer, I believe, who had the power to cripple people. And when they were trying to capture him in a sting operation, it went bad. And this mutant left Aaron Kearse with a crippled arm.
So there are two big backstory revelations about the main characters. Yes. Kathy Graves is that her daughter, named after her mother, her baby Moira, you know, is engulfed in flames and died because of her mutant power, which is parallel to the Paul Jenkins story about Sally Floyd that was explored in Generation M. I got to interview Paul about that story. Sally had a daughter named Minnie who aged in reverse and they couldn't stabilize her and she faded out of existence. That was just referenced recently in Alex Pagnadel's X-Men from the Ashes story and the Infinity Comics, if anyone's reading. And the revelation about Aaron Kearse and his boss, Agent Green, are that they came across this mutant arms dealer named Ashton Wither, who basically can drain the life out of one of your limbs or kill you. He's got kind of one of those plague or Kevin Ford Wither, like he can touch you and drain your life out. So Kearse has lost use of his arm, as has his boss, his director, who's his truest friend, who at the end, by the way, ends up being corrupt. So let's talk about issue one just a little bit and kind of break down some of the plot points. There's a press conference by the Mutant Rights Task Force. Jean Grey is there and messages Kathy Grey in her mind, like, hey, you need to watch out for your partner. By the way, we're keeping an eye on you. There was this murder on the Hollywood sign, right? The Mutant Civil Rights Task Force, or MCRTF, goes after an anti-mutant named Alex Klaus and his allies, realizing that they've been planning an attack on the Mutant Pride Parade that's coming up. And the victim, Aaron Sumner, was part of this group. They also learned that Sumner was not a mutant, that he had a mutant liver grafted into his body. They then investigate a lead with a really fascinating character that I would actually love to see in the comics again, a guy named Sterling Whitman, who is a white Hollywood director who made a buttload of money off of blaxploitation films. There's this great moment where he's talking about like, oh, look at all I did for black people. And Kathy Gray's looking at this poster with this like tokenized black woman. I'm like, yeah, you did a real great job. There's a big party at his house. The big secret here is Whitman has a mutant child named Malcolm Whitman, who is a pyrokinetic, but his own flesh will burn. And he's kind of this mutant revolutionary, and his dad's trying to cover up his crimes by bribing the FBI agents. And when they disagree, he's like, you Nazis, I'll take you down. And he like calls their director. Of course, the Kathy Grace speaks out to him in kind of a sarcastic way. And like she later gets called out for her quote unquote outburst, which is the oppression that black women face in the workplace quite often. They question a guy named Dean Crawford, who is one of the allies, but Malcolm Whitman murders him from far away. He's watching and burns this guy alive. Soon there's a big shootout. Malcolm Whitman is confronting everyone. Jean Grey and Cyclops show up and Malcolm ends up dying in the end. But everybody kind of realizes that their memories have been altered about events as well. Like something's going on to change their perception of what is happening. Kevin, what were your thoughts on issue one? What stood out to you? Malcolm is gross to look at. He's one of those mutants you're like, whoa.
This art is great. Yeah, the art in this is really great because it's very human and a little less fantasy than you normally see in comics. And so it adds, I think, a little bit to that grittiness. I thought it was really moving, especially like we were saying, this is 22 years later. We're looking at this stuff of how like now it feels with some of these kinds of takes on how people behave against minorities and who's struggling with this and how people are treating each other. I thought it was also really interesting to see the two kind of straight white males being disabled early on in this and how they're dealing with not being kind of at the apex of of where they should be and kind of how that affects their anger and their kind of working on this. So it made me again feel them more fleshed out than being cardboard cutouts of like, oh, this is just the religious dude who feels this way. Like it did add a lot to this. So it got me very invested very quickly in this. I loved kind of the way that the X-Men were treated as these kind of ghostly figures that kind of come in, Jean Grey being there, not being there, being in your mind, saying things kind of aggressive in her Jean Grey way. She's very consistent and very on brand, you know, deciding that she knew best. And I loved how that kind of helped direct us to how we should feel about some of these characters a little bit, depending on our love of the X-Men. There was just so much going on in this first episode that I was there for it. It felt cinematic. I felt very much like, to the earlier point of this, felt like either a TV show or a movie in the way that it was kind of unfolding. And it really gave it a grounded feel for me. I liked it.
I love any book that makes me slow down to read the story and notice the art, right? And this is a dense book. If you don't look for the stuff in the background, you don't get all of the nuance of the story. Issue number two is called The Natural. And this is a mutant baseball player named Tony Robb. And the reveal, this guy's super famous. He's like a crazy home run hitter. And like Kersey and his child have idolized this guy for many years. But his big secret is that he's a mutant that secretes, and his sweat allows him to be perceived however he wants. This kind of makes me think of that character. Who's the guy that like you look at him and you remember him, but when you look away, you forget him? I'm forgetting his name right now. It's hilarious. Yeah.
No, he's great character.
That's funny. A Cy Spurrier character whose name is completely forget me not. That's funny that I forgot
his name. There you go.
So his dad taught him how to use his powers ethically. And one time when he was a kid, Tony Robb used his powers to get a home run in a game. But baseball was taught to him to kind of keep his focus so that he would never take advantage. But now it's starting to travel around that he might be a mutant, and some people are targeting him. Because if this celebrity is a mutant, then what does that mean? And this takes me in my brain back to Greg Laganis and other really famous people who, coming out as gay, especially during the AIDS crisis, was so controversial, and it's something we still face quite often. Kersey submits himself to an operation to get a new cybernetic arm. It doesn't kind of work the best, but he's trying to make it work. We also see Kathy Gray get a visit from her mother, Moira, who's really concerned about the task force. And Kathy's like, fuck you. Like, you haven't been around my whole childhood. I haven't talked to you in years, and now you're like hiding in my car to like warn me about my boss. Leave me alone. There's a schizophrenic man who is manipulated, we learn later, into firing at Tony Robb during the game. He uses his powers to save himself, but ends up shot in the leg. It costs him his career. And Nightcrawler shows up in like just one page to stop the assassin. So the X-Men are very close to this the whole time. They're kind of always right off the panel watching to make sure things go well.
Well, I really like this issue. I think it's probably my favorite one of the series. I just kind of like the standalone nature of it all. It kind of really hits hard the storytelling franchise of it all, where it's a case of the week set within this larger world of this interesting period of time in mutant history, in which, you know, there's a lot of things like Tony, the baseball player, has been convinced by the mutant civil rights movement to kind of come out and go public with his powers and kind of explain his story. But he's very conflicted about that, and he's not exactly sure whether he wants to be that kind of icon. And there's definitely a downside to that, right? He's ambivalent about that. And I also really liked, like, as we getting to know the characters, the lead characters, Kersey and Catherine's backstories, and the whole, this is kind of where I kind of feel like this is the issue that really kind of offers kind of like the operational idea of Kersey. It would feel good to be strong again is like a line that's kind of like throughout in ways that are good and then really bad and scary. And
yeah, it sounds a little too much like Make America Great Again. I can't go there.
Right. My hope was that it would be a little bit more complicated than that, kind of like, you know, from his point of view. But as we get deeper into the series, it really becomes very MAGA, doesn't it? Like,
well, and it's okay to have characters that are wrestling with these types of things. I think we need to see those perspectives. I love when I get a random issue of Avengers that tells us like the story of why that guy joined Hydra before he ended up dying in the streets, you know? Like, I think it's interesting sometimes.
There was also something really interesting about this episode, with it feeling very now again, with the kind of athlete trans debate that's going on. When he's questioning Tony about, like, well, have you ever used your powers to cheat? There was, I couldn't help but associate it with what's going on right now in the Olympics and how we're having people assuming that if somebody else can do better, that they must somehow be cheating and they don't deserve it for some reason. And I just found that to be really multi-layered again, and giving Aaron something for him to, you know, respond to.
GEICO makes it easy to get affordable renter's insurance in as little as 90 seconds. And then you'll start to wonder why everything else isn't so fast. Like, why does it take so long to do the dishes? A meal that's gone in 3 requires 45 minutes worth of dishes. Doesn't make sense. But it does make sense to get renter's insurance through GEICO. That way, that pile of dirty dishes and the other things you love are covered. Get more with GEICO.
Shades that and makes it a little bit more sympathetic to me is that's very much on the mind of that kind of idea that you just said is very much on the mind of the series. But from a Kersey standpoint, he also knows how much his son idolizes this guy. And he's almost kind of looking out for his son's own hero worship of this guy, i.e. now that we know what his power is and we know how this baseball player could be tempted to use his power to cheat, like, Kersey's also thinking, can my son, for that reason alone, continue to look up to this baseball player after he comes out? Not just because I might have problems with him as a mutant, but like, does he really have any ethical integrity? Can we really trust him? Because that's why both he and his, like, he plays the game the right way. And that's a big part of the appeal of this guy, of this baseball player to Kersey, who's very interested in doing things the right way. Although his right way is literally capital R and very flawed. He's looking out for that part too. I was going for that kind of complexity of both of that.
There's an interesting kind of scale for this guy, because a mutant attacked me and hurt me and permanently damaged me and left me disabled. I understand that fear. And we also learn when his church was voting to become a sanctuary church or not, he didn't vote for or against. He just abstained to watch. But then he's scared of, like, oh no, what if my kid meets a mutant? Or what if someone good turns out to be a mutant? How will that affect my child? I'm much less patient with that thought. But I do enjoy the complexity of it.
Yeah, it's all in him. And I kind of feel like there was a lot of people, like, I remember writing, when I was writing that, I loved layering and loading all of these characters with all of this stuff in them. I think that some of my editors at the time and some of the readers maybe too would have preferred if I simplified them a little bit more. But I don't know. Like, I was just drawn with making everyone as messy as possible. No one is ideologically clean or coherent. All just really messy. And most of them don't know how to manage it and are struggling to figure out how to act well within their messiness. And that is something that is always interesting to me as a writer. We're all very complicated. Very few of us have sorted all of our shit out in a way that makes us coherent people. And we're trying to figure out how to live well and ethically and lovingly while being very messy and under the influence of so many, like, influences and causes for our behavior.
Kevin is feeling very seen right now. It's like you're talking about his dating life.
Well, yeah, it's very much that. But also, we have to remember when you wrote this, this is what, a year after 9/11? And you probably were writing it much closer to that time period. Talk about messy. Talk about a lot of fear, a lot of stress and tension in everyone's lives. So, like, I feel that. I get that from this. I think it makes sense, especially in the time that you wrote this, why these characters are having these kinds of reactions to every major decision. It's a lot of fear.
Yeah.
It would have been very different with 9 issues. I think we would have had much more time to delve into the complexities. But it's well done in 4.
Release the other issues.
Or at least, at least bring these characters back. I think it'd be really interesting. We'll talk about that. Issue 3 is called Weeds. There's a guy named Kyle Nakamura, and I want to be very clear as well. I noticed, Jeff, that as you're describing different criminals from different complexities, you're really sure to use people from different racial backgrounds. Like, it creates a complexity of the story where you're kind of seeing this from all angles. So Kyle Nakamura is an anti-mutant kid who, again, is being manipulated by this task force leadership, but he has designed a bomb, and he blows up a mutant church in San Francisco, killing 29 innocent mutants inside. There are four that survive that are somehow indestructible, and they approach him, and he's almost like having this like angelic experience. He killed a bunch of people, and now there's these four mutants that walk out unharmed, and it's very scary. Kathy is arguing with her husband Ramon because he's learned she's considering an abortion. She doesn't want her kid to be a mutant. She doesn't want to go through that again. In Oklahoma, Kersey is with the FBI when they discover a farmhouse where mutant illegals are being forced by the mob to make cheap electronics. The mob man is like killed and the mutants are freed, and they run toward Kersey like, thank you. And he's like, no, don't fucking touch me, you're disgusting. And he has this very internal reaction to that. Again, this is also cover for the corrupt organization we learn later that the Civil Rights Task Force has set up this base and has the mob with these illegal mutants. Wolverine confronts Kersey and is like, look, unless you get justice and go after this Nakamura guy, like, I'll do it for you, and you're going to learn, you know, what it's like to cross me. And there's also a really interesting scene between Kersey and Gray discussing, you know, what the Bible says or does not say about mutants. Moira Gray shows back up and she's like, hey, daughter, like, it's still corrupt. Like, you still got to watch out. She's like, Mom, leave me alone. They eventually realize Kendall Green, their director, is corrupt. They close in on Nakamura. And these four invulnerable mutants are there. Nakamura is using them as a shield. He ends up dead. And Jean Grey shows up to kind of take these four surviving mutants into safety. And again, it's kind of a religious experience for Kersey again, as he's looking forward and seeing like, oh my God, I'm discussing religion, but here's these angelic creatures that seem to be passing into heaven while I'm left here wounded. It's also interesting as they close in on Nakamura, there's like this anti-mutant preacher who's probably William Stryker, just like televangelizing like, loudspeaker, like how evil mutants are and how God doesn't love them. This issue really stands out as the turning point. And I could see you doing multiple more issues, but this is kind of the penultimate, right? Like it's the revelation of the corruption and like what's really at stake. 29 lives have just been taken.
Yeah. Is this also the issue where I wrote the line like, the distinctive smell of moldy trench coat? And that's when
yes.
That's how Catherine knows that her mom has showed up or something. But that's what I remember about the issue. There's a lot of scenes in this issue that I really, really love. Like I really liked writing the whole raid on the house with the preacher, like just the weirdness and the ominousness and the menace of this preacher's like sermon, kind of like this hate preacher's sermon, like echoing through the house as Gray and Kersey kind of infiltrate it. And they find the four mutant kids and then realizing that, oh my gosh, our bad guys using them as a human shield. There's some really great sequence in there. This is the issue though that really like, I mean, two things. One is this is kind of culminates the real James Ellroy Underworld USA influence on the plot of the whole thing, because one of the central premises of Ellroy's work there is that Hoover was using both the mob and running militant groups around the country to achieve his own ends and his own ideological goals. So I'm borrowing from those kinds of conspiracy fiction and real history kind of influences there. And we get the mob angle there here in this comic. But like, it's also kind of things that like, if I had more issues, I would have explored more and sank more deeply in. I'm glad that you guys find it compelling in its really compressed form. Me, it's like, I want three issues to explore this. So like, but maybe I also have a tendency to go on and on and on, as this podcast might be demonstrating. And so maybe,
you're doing great.
But being succinct maybe helps this comic in some ways.
Well, yeah, but you also write a tight script here for sure. I think you tell a full story, which is amazing. There's fast forward to the most recent season of The Boys. For those of you that are watching, the character that plays the presidential candidate who can make your head explode, she's a closeted superhero running on a pro superhero platform, and you kind of watch her go down the rabbit hole of like, okay, well, I guess we're implementing internment camps and I'm signing deals with white billionaires, and you know, at the end she has the change of heart. But these are stories told over and over and over in our politics. Go to the main show in August where we're discussing the Secret Empire's infiltration of the United States government in 1974, which is another X-Men story. Kevin, what were your thoughts on the X-Men's presence in these books, seeing Jean Grey, Nightcrawler, Wolverine, wolverines. Oh my god, showing up.
It was so good because they became these like mythical beings with the way they were treated. So by them having these kinds of like sweep in, sweep out, even the new mutant kids that are in the explosion, when they're seen, they act almost like the separate cuckoos, like they're kind of emotionless and special and greater than, and having it so clearly set from the human's point of view of these like godlike characters gives this perfect feeling every time that they X-Men show up. First of all, it's a tease, like there's a little bit of X-Men here, a little bit of X-Men there, but then with them being these kinds of like godlike beings that just sweep in, tell somebody something and sweep out, the idea that like I think it's probably Aaron who's so freaked out by Jean Grey touching his mind too. It's like, I don't want to interact with these people. I don't want them changing me. I like me and I like my life. And there's something that then you understand his fear in general and how he acts out of fear for some of this stuff. And I just thought it was a great way that the X-Men were treated throughout the series. But this episode, especially when you see the new kid mutants that are also behaving in this kind of slightly cold, distant way.
Yeah, it's interesting you should say that because one of the notes I got from editors on this particular issue in an admirable way, which I really appreciated, was, oh, like we forget that for a normal human person, regardless of the way they ideologically view the world, most mutants, or specifically many of the mutants we see featured in X-Men comics, would be scary. And particularly like whether it's Nightcrawler and the way that he looks, or Wolverine. And that was the idea that, like, you know, this guy with these metal claws that come out of his hand and stuff like that, and his whole personality. Wolverine is a very intimidating and fearsome person, and people would be scared of him. Now, there are ideological reasons and not necessarily great reasons why Kirstie is scared of mutants too, but just in general, I was just really attracted to by how in X-Men comics and the X-Men world, so many mutant powers are not are just manifest in very scary ways. Like Cyclops, you know, Cyclops has uncontrollable eye blasts that need to be contained by a visor. This idea that these powers might be like empowering, but also a curse, or might be a source of body horror. Like I've always been really intrigued by that.
And that's where the mutant metaphor could only go so far, because superpowers are much more dangerous than queerness, you know. But we love that about our characters too, the deep flaws. I love a series that has a strong ending. I want to read a payoff. I want to read a conclusion. And issue 4 does that. Issue 4 is called Fear and Loathing. We open with a guy named Ari Hassan who has joined the anti-mutant group. He puts in a cyanide tooth. He's been really upset about the recent news in the country, and he's been sent again by this corrupt task force that they don't know yet to bomb the Xavier school. My favorite part of this book is just this kind of gentle interaction of how mutants are all over the place. We see Kirstie and Grey on the plane. They've both been affected by mutants. There's a magazine cover that features like what's the world for mutants now, and my favorite, and this will be the cover art for this episode, is there's a scene in the airport where there's a woman with feathers kissing a man who's wearing a Remember Genosha shirt. And the idea of just that kind of all around, it's my single favorite image in the whole series. Grey and Kirstie go to Director Green's home, and they look into his computer and discover like his files. He's basically transferring it all over to Kirstie. And he's like, if you're listening to this, that means I'm dead. Here's all my files. Here's all the corruption. We've been behind it all. The mutants are going to take over the humans in like less than 5 generations. So we've been trying to create some safety for everybody. But Paul Duncan is still alive. We don't know if he's related to Fred Duncan or not, the FBI agent ally of the Avengers, or excuse me, of the X-Men, who is connected to the character Executioner, or Carl Denti, which is an odd X-Men villain, also a corrupt FBI.
I'm going to let you imagine that to be true.
All it takes is one last dialogue cool somewhere. To me.
Sounds like true. Something that I really intended, but like, let's go with that.
They sneak into Duncan's basement. They find more evidence of like super corrupt crimes, and the mutant Ashton Wither has been kept there, chained to the wall, his powers blocked, you know, shit in his own pants, just like miserable, emaciated. They let him go. Duncan charges in. He's going to kill everybody. Wither kills Duncan and then dies because he is very weak. So at the very end, we see Grey and kind of Kirstie opening up to each other. Kirstie says, I'm trying not to hate mutants so much. She, you know, admits, I watched my daughter burn before my eyes. And they go after the terrorist that's going to the Jean Grey school. And Kirstie is ready to sacrifice himself to save the mutants, which is amazing. And Jean Grey has to step in at the last minute to save the day. The X-Men leave a thank you note. Beast fixed Kirstie's cybernetic arm to make it better. And he's like, you know, let me know what you think. Grey makes amends with her husband and her mother. We don't know if she got the abortion or not. She just wants to go home and, you know, make up her mind when she's not feeling quite so emotional. Kirstie then goes to the deputy or to the director of the FBI, who's named Director Stone, and tells him everything that happened. And my understanding of this ending is Stone convinced Kirstie to burn all of the evidence in exchange for, I'll give you a promotion to run the task force. So he made this kind of corrupt decision at the end. And you kind of don't know where it goes from there. This is a character we definitely need to see again. What are your thoughts on the conclusion of this, Kevin, and then Jeff?
I loved it. I got emotional with all of it. When Kathy hugs her mom in the hospital room, I was there for that. I don't know why that arc was a really perfect arc for me. Again, the nice little beast making the new arm. I got warm, fuzzy feelings over that. There was a lot of nice wrap up to this. But to your point, I want to know more about these characters' lives. I think they're interesting characters. They're main characters I want to follow. I think they're really flawed and varied. And I could definitely see more of this.
Yeah, that's cool. I would love to write more. Because I want to know what Kirstie does next. But I also was good with the ambiguity as an ending too, if we never told more stories, because I thought it was kind of fair to the moment that I was writing. Like, where are we going to go from here? Placed at Kirstie's feet at the end, given control over this department. He's going to decide where to go from here. Is he going to, you know, execute this like department ethically? Is he going to like be influenced by his worst demons and run it in a bad, corrupt fashion? We just kind of don't know. We're maybe kind of given a hint for a hopeful ending when I think that the series ends with him and his son discussing the story of the Good Samaritan and how ultimately for him that presents a way forward for what kind of person he wants to be in the world. I wouldn't say that like he's like cured or makes, you know, he's now corrected in all of his beliefs and attitudes. What I really liked about the ending for these two characters is how vulnerable they are with each other about their past, their trauma, their weakness, the things about themselves that they like, that they don't like. And I think that like what I was hoping for is that this is the beginning of a way forward to being better people for them.
This series is quite resonant. I kind of feel like it didn't end well for Kirstie. I'm kind of guessing this guy joined Orcus.
Oh no, maybe.
Comics.
I could see him there. Yes, he would be an Orcus.
But I could also see Kathy Gray there too. It's interesting.
Oh, don't say that. That makes me sad.
You know, I don't want that, but I think it could happen. And there's a lot of interesting places we could put these characters in the comics with a unique point of view, just as a villain with a line of dialogue that tells us like where they're at and where they're coming from. And the right connection with the right hero puts them on a different path. I would love to see Kathy Gray interact with Charlotte Jones, for example. That would be fascinating. The Duncan comparison that I made earlier, I think is really interesting. And Kirstie, with almost anyone, interacting with a character like William Stryker or Graydon Creed would be a fascinating interchange on the page. There's a number of mutant characters here that we haven't seen again either. The baseball player, etc. It's interesting to see a X-Men book from kind of the perspective of the humans. This is one of the few that we ever get in this regard, and it's an interesting exploration. Alex Pacnadel is putting out a series called Sentinel pretty soon that I think is going to be very similar, where it's kind of from that perspective. It's a 5-issue series I'm looking forward to. Kevin, what are some of your thoughts as we're kind of wrapping up our exploration of this series? What vibes are you sitting with?
I have to say, when I sit and think about this after absorbing it, I understand editorial's decision that X Factor was the title they chose for this. And I'll tell you why. It's because I feel like the core of X Factor, if you take away the superhero character, it is about this different, more governmental kind of framework around the X universe. And so they have a history of that in whether they're forming a detective agency, an investigation group, a secret group between, like, there's always this kind of other governmental kind of mixture that the other teams don't have to deal with the same degree. So it feels like I understand why X-Factor is the title. I really appreciated, as much as Kirstie wasn't my character I was rooting for per se, I loved the struggle of somebody, because, you know, I may not be the biggest fan of people who use religion as a weapon. And so seeing somebody who's religious, I'm always on guard to begin with. But to see somebody struggling to do what they know was the good part of their religious, you know, experience, and knowing that their heart doesn't want to do that in every case, and this back and forth. And I thought he very consistently, you know, Jeff, you wrote him in this struggle throughout. And so that ending was a really, while ambiguity was part of it, I think there is a sense of he understood how much he needs to fight for that.
Proper
I don't
Marvel,
know, something really nice.
Proper Marvel writers leave the story in a concluding space, but also put the toys back in the toy box for those that want to pick them back up. And there's some interesting characters here that are ready to be explored. And we see these, you know, obscure characters show up in various like little panels once in a while. You know, for Mutant X, the character Bouncer shows up on Krakoa for like an issue. Steve Orlando brought like that mutant tree guy from District X into Marauders. Like, it's fun when you get to see these deeples. And there's some really interesting characters here. I like the complexity of these stories. I like how every character is a little bit off on the moral scale. It's well done. The violence on the page remains jarring to me. The, you know, the bombings and the shootings and the dismemberments. But I think it's really well done, Jeff. It's when I reread this series, that's the reason I first reached out to you to come back on the show. And I'm like, oh, this is the guy that wrote that Beast and the Cat story too. We got to talk.
Yeah, that too. Yeah, you know, rereading the series, or actually for me skimming it, I really appreciated you doing the job of really carrying the plot summary here, because I don't think I would have done as good of a job. I was struck by a couple things. Just how much the graphic novel God Loves, Man Kills made a huge impact on me as a young reader of the X-Men and framed what I wanted from an X-Men story. It's not even the mutant metaphor anymore. It's just so transparent about what it's about, and very blunt and on the nose, and not afraid of leaning into that, including the, you know, the hardness of reality and the violence of it all. And that kind of leads me into many of the motifs that I just chose to kind of boldly like, and I don't see that in a braggy way, but just like I understand how they're very explicit and blunt and in your face what I'm drawing from, and as well as just the violence of it all. And I felt like God Loves, Man Kills kind of gives permission for that, like as a child of 80s comics and early 90s comics that get more explicit, get more edgy, get more overtly political. I'm wearing all my influences on my sleeve in these four issues of this comic.
You're a talented writer, my friend. Watchmen is at the top of the list, but I enjoy everything of yours that I have written. It's been a joy to explore this with you both today. I had a really good time. This series is now cemented in my brain in a really lovely way. It's a permanent place in my little X encyclopedia repository up here. If you guys want to share, as we're wrapping our thoughts up, is there a particular place you'd enjoy seeing these characters back in 2024, particularly Kirstie or Gray? I also think that that Hollywood blaxploitation director guy would be really interesting to he's a fascinating kind of Elon Musk level character that you want to punch in the face a little bit, but makes him an interesting and compelling villain. So I'd love to hear any final thoughts. And we're going to put this out on August 28th on the Patreon. Is there anything you'd like to plug? Where can people find you online? Let's go, Jeff, then Kevin.
Yeah, I mean, I'm as fascinated and troubled by the Kirstie character as you guys, and which makes him kind of irresistible to want to return to. You're kind of talking me into how resonant X-Factor was to today's world. And I'd love to see kind of, particularly Kirstie is left in a position of power and we're not necessarily sure we can trust him with it. I'd love to see how that turns out and how he kind of, and where his own conscience takes him, if his spiritual nature and interests are genuine and earnest, where that takes him and how that might conflict with his feelings of political or ideological obligation. So as I daydream about writing that series in the future, which will probably never come to pass, I'm kind of quietly working on some other things that I can't really talk about. Hopefully you'll see next year.
Excellent, excellent. And where can people find you?
You could find me on EW Doc Jensen. That's my handle. That kind of goes back to my days as a writer for Entertainment Weekly, writing obsessively about the show Lost. I'm on other social media platforms.
So I would love, now that you've mentioned them and Orcus, I kind of want to see them as moles and Orcus a bit, or maybe some continuation of Sword and some kind of way that these two characters are playing into the government, like behind the scenes kind of stuff. I would follow their journey through that entire piece. So somehow I would love to see them live on.
Yeah, Kersey with Valerie Cooper or Henry Peter Gyrick, fascinating.
Right? Yeah. Like, that's what I want. I want a TV show of like that kind of interaction. I would watch that. It's low budget on the special effects, but I would be so into the drama. I'll be at the Uncanny Experience, the X-Men convention in Minneapolis in September, and then I can be found on Instagram at KAKINIRY.
Lastly, I'm Chad Ederson. I keep my own social media private because I got kiddos. The two of you are welcome to follow me. Just ask. I will also be at the Uncanny Experience. We will be putting this out after my return from FlameCon. It's been such a busy summer on the show and in real life. I will be glad that summer is ending. It's been real fucking hot here for too long. I'm so tired of it. The next episode you can watch for on the Patreon after this is all about the character Ozymandias, the weird little stone guy that hangs out with Apocalypse. Anthony Oliveira and Leah Williams are joining me for that, which is amazing. Out on the main show, we will be delving into Defenders number 15 in the first week of September, which is going to result in Defenders 16, where Magneto gets changed into a baby. It's delightful.
Oh, yes.
So good.
For that episode, I'll be welcoming the incredible talents of our Steve Siegel and Adam Polina to the show, and my friend Emmett Yanamura will be rejoining us. Gray Malkin Lane is Gray Malkin _Lane on Instagram. That's the easiest place to find us. Any final thoughts from either of you before we wrap up?
Thanks for having me, and thanks for remembering this weird little footnote in X-Men history.
What a delight.
I am so glad. What a delight. That's exactly right. What a delight.
It's been a joy. Okay, thanks everybody for listening. We will see you back here next time on the Gray Malkin Lane Patreon channel.
It's Ram Truck Month. Hurry in for great deals on the trucks built to help you drive your own story. Take center stage with Ram 1500's available 540 horsepower Hurricane engine. Command the spotlight in our most luxurious Ram 1500. Or steal the show with the new Ram heavy duty lineup with an available Cummins high output turbo diesel engine. Hurry in and drive your own story with Ram 1500, Motor Trend's 2025 Truck of the Year during Ram Truck Month. Ram is a registered trademark of FCA US LLC.